WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I'm very excited at the opportunity to be speaking with a very gifted cartoonist, painter, and novelist by the name of Peter Steiner. I am sure that many of you have seen some of the cartoons of Peter Steiner that have been published in The New Yorker magazine over the last several decades. Probably the most famous is a cartoon he did in which the caption read, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." And of all of the cartoons that have been in The New Yorker, that's probably been reproduced the most. But in addition to his talent as a cartoonist, he is also a marvelous novelist. And I have been devouring his latest novel, which is called The Good Cop. And this novel is set amidst the turmoil of 1920s Munich, Germany, as the nation of Germany is reeling from the after effects of the First World War. And in that turmoil, of course, arises Adolf Hitler. And it is a situation in which life is very frightening in Germany. And in some ways that some would say are a bit reminiscent of some of what we are experiencing today, both here and abroad. And the novel is beautifully crafted and full of suspense. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with the gifted writer responsible for it. Again, the novel is The Good Cop. And Peter Steiner, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I wonder if you could just say something about how different it is to write a novel versus to compose one of those classic single-panel cartoons for The New Yorker magazine. They just seem like two completely different creative endeavors. Are they as different as they would appear to be at a glance?
Well, there are certain obvious differences. One is that writing a book takes a long time and drawing a cartoon doesn't. Once you've had the idea for the cartoon, and even getting the idea is usually pretty quick, the drawing takes a matter of minutes, the first draft anyway, and you'll have a finished drawing fairly quickly, whereas a novel takes months and even years. That's one obvious difference, but there are some similarities, too. I mean, a cartoon, even though it's a very short story, tells a story. And so there is a kind of narrative that has to be constructed as there is in a novel. But the impulse to do those things is also very different. So, they're extremely different.
Right. Can you just say a little bit about that experience of creating one of these cartoons? You've already said that it's, in terms of time span, it is a different kind of creative endeavor than, for instance, the crafting of a full-fledged novel. What is that process like? Is it pretty much the same cartoon to cartoon, or is each creative endeavor, even with something as relatively simple as a cartoon, is each its sort of own unique adventure?
Well, each is its own adventure in a way. Making a cartoon for me usually, but not always, starts with just sitting down with a pad of paper and maybe a magazine or a book and just browsing and trying to free up my mind to make the necessary odd connections that are in every cartoon. You know, the good cartoons all have something sort of bizarre connection. For instance, dogs and computers. And once you've got an interesting connection, then you try to sort of make the connection make sense and be funny, of course. But sometimes the procedure is the opposite. I'm not coming up with anything that way, and I'll just sit down and start drawing and see what comes from a drawing. And in fact, that internet dog cartoon came about that way. I did the drawing before I had the idea. It was sort of a caption contest kind of thing where I had to come up with a caption once I had the drawing. So, that's the procedure. Mm-hmm. And writing for me is not all that different. I don't plan out my novels. I don't know where they're going. Very often I'll have a first sentence and not much more, or a character in mind and not much more, and start with that, and then it sort of builds. And I end up having to write the novel in order to read it, in a way.
When did you first begin undertaking novels, and what was sort of the catalyst that prompted you to attempt such a thing for the first time?
I started very late in life. I guess I was somewhere around 60 or close to it. And my father was ill and was dying. And I wanted to keep a sort of record of my feelings about him and thoughts about him and sort out some of the issues that are always there between fathers and sons. And so I started writing about that, and somehow it didn't go anywhere, but it occurred to me if I had invented a fictitious father and son and put them in a sort of dire situation, it might be a more interesting way to do it. And I did that, and it sort of evolved into a novel, and I showed it to a friend, and he liked it, and said he knew an agent. Showed it to the agent, and the agent was interested. So, you know, it sort of all happened rather accidentally.
Well, I think you are clearly a very, very gifted writer, and it's just sort of intriguing to think about somebody having such a gift and yet having that gift, in a sense, off to the side because of this other creative endeavor which sort of occupied most of your time and energy. I'm just really glad that whether or not it was pure happenstance that this was something that you ended up trying and of course liking and succeeding in. I'm sure you're grateful as well. That
I'm extremely grateful. I enjoy it a great deal, and because it's not a career for me in the sense of something I need to do to make a living. It's all the more fun that way, you know. It's something that you don't do for the money, but just for the love of it.
I'm speaking with on this portion of the morning show with one of the country's most renowned cartoonists, Peter Steiner, who is also now a very gifted novelist, and his most recent novel is titled "The Good Cop." And as I said in the introduction, it is set in Germany in those tumultuous years immediately following the First World War. Mr. Steiner, I understand that at least part of what prompted you to set this novel in this particular time and place probably has a little bit to do with who you are and, in a sense, who you come from. Tell our listeners about your parents and their experience, and in a sense, how that has been a powerful influence on you, and I should guess a powerful influence on this novel.
Well, you're right. It is an important influence and impetus to write this book. My father and my mother were both born and grew up in Vienna, Austria, and my father, being Jewish, had to flee the country in 1938, and my mother, who was not Jewish but was engaged to him, followed him a year later. And my father had been, they were both from sort of illustrious families, but all that was left behind, and my father had been trained as a lawyer, but when he got to the United States, he had to find work, mainly menial work, because his law degree was of no use here. And he found work in Cincinnati, Ohio, and that's where I grew up. Austrian and German culture has always been a big part of my life, and lo and behold, when I was in the army, I was stationed in Germany. I had spent my junior year in Germany, and I got out of the army. I went to graduate school in German literature, so I ended up teaching German for a number of years at Dickinson College, and in the course of that time, I studied lots of great literature, which this is a sort of sideline, which helped me learn how to write by reading Thomas Mann and Franz Kafka and writers like that. So it all fed into this novel, although this is the sixth novel I've written. This is the first one set in Germany and in circumstances that were not entirely unfamiliar to me.
Right. The first character that we meet in this novel, and the date is November 11th, 1918, is Sergeant Maximilian Wolf. And there is an interesting parallel between Maximilian Wolf and you. Explain to our listeners who he is.
Well, Maximilian, he's quite young when he goes into the army, and he ends up spending the whole war in the trenches and having a pretty rough time of it, but coming out more or less intact. And he's an artist. I don't know how long he's been drawing, but when we meet him, he has already been drawing pictures of the war. And he comes back to Munich, and he's looking for work, and he can't find anything. I mean, there just isn't much work. And then he happens on a little newspaper that's looking for a reporter. And though he doesn't get the reporter's job, it occurs to him that the newspaper, which is called the New Picture, doesn't have any pictures in it. So he offers to do drawings for them, and they pay him a tiny salary. And that starts his career as a newspaper artist. So that he and I have a great deal in common there. And in fact, when I started the book with him, I assumed that he was going to be the main character, but turned out he wasn't. That sort of happened when the police inspector showed up, police detective, and he was the one that I had to. I realized I wanted to show how people react when times go bad. And of course, the focus of times going bad would very often be the criminal justice and the legal system. So having a cop at the center of the story seemed important to me.
Right. And that is the good cop who
yep.
is named in the title of the book, whom we will talk about in just a moment. So this this first character we meet, Maximilian Wolf, who is a talented artist doing drawings. He draws all kinds of different things that he observes all over the city, including various political rallies. He gets into, in a sense, a bit of trouble because of a series of drawings that he did of Orthodox Jews. It is, or I guess maybe a better way to say it is that these drawings that he makes end up being used in a way that he did not intend. Explain to our listeners what these drawings were, and this moment in Maximilian Wolff's life that is, in a sense, a portent of what is to come.
Yeah, well, he his job for the newspaper, as he understands it and as the editor understood it too, is to go around the city doing drawings of whatever he finds with life in the city. He finds all sorts of things, and there are lots of, in Munich at the time, there were Orthodox Jews, and they were interesting. They looked different in their different garb, and he does a drawing of that. And the paper prints it, and has it along with an editorial by the publisher about how the Jews are aliens in Germany and disrupting German culture and that sort of typical anti-Semitic stuff. And Maximilian objects to his editor, and his editor explains to him the publisher is also the owner of the paper, and he'll put in whatever he likes, and Maximilian has very little choice. So he leaves. Hmm. He's fired. And he finds another job with a social democrat paper, the Munich Post, which is actually an actual paper, and something I knew nothing about and was shocked to learn about.
Hmm. And
They opposed Hitler from the very beginning and exposed his lies, and of course, when Hitler came to power, they were shut down, and many were sent to concentration camps, and others were killed or fled.
Hmm. It's very interesting when this happens. That is the first thing for Maximilian Wolff, when these drawings of Orthodox Jews are published, but with this headline, Foreign Ways Threaten Our German Republic, and unwittingly his drawings are being used in a way that he never intended. And when he shares his frustration with Inga, I forget her connection with Maximilian.
Oh, it's his sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
And she doesn't, in a sense, share his misgivings. And when Maximilian asks Inga, you know, doesn't this bother you? And she says, no, frankly, it doesn't. If anything, it doesn't go far enough. The Jews are behind everything that's wrong. They run the banks. They're behind the so-called treaty that's taken everything from us. They're not Germans. Who do you think is collecting the reparations? The Jews. And when Maximilian asks, how do you know that? She responds, you just have to look around. Open your eyes. Tell us more about this attitude that became more and more pervasive among the German population in the early 1920s. Explain to our listeners where this deep resentment towards the Jews, where that came from, and what was prompting people like the character Inga to express what she does at this moment.
It's hard for me to say where that came from. I think a historian could probably answer that question better than I, but it's something that's been part of not just German culture, but I'd say all Western cultures and many other cultures as well. The Jews have always been the scapegoats, and there's all sorts of mythology built up around them, the business about them getting the reparations that she cites. So that's all nonsense. It's just made-up stuff. And you can hear it now here in the United States. I mean, I think it's always been there a little bit underneath the surface, but it's now our president has given people permission to talk that way, or at least they feel he has. And So it's a kind of everybody needs a boogeyman, somebody that's sort of making their life worse, generally, so they don't have to take responsibility for it, or just simply because they don't understand the way the world works. I don't know what more to say about it. I mean, her explanation of things is something you can hear people saying now about Muslims or about Jews.
And what's interesting is the very vivid way in which you describe some of the first rallies of the new German Workers' Party, which, of course, is the banner, in a sense, of this young man by the name of Adolf Hitler. I wonder if you could talk about the study that you did of this period and what you were able to learn about some of these first rallies at which Adolf Hitler spoke and in which he was able to stoke some of this simmering resentment that was already there and, of course, draw it out in really ugly ways.
Yeah. Well, Germany was such a mess at the time. The Treaty of Versailles really just completely destroyed the country and crippled them. And the reparations were terrible and impossible to pay. And people were, of course, unemployed, and there was starvation. There was the country was just on its back, and people needed a hero. They needed somebody to lift them out of this misery, and make them the great country they had once been, and. So they were searching for somebody who could do this, and Hitler, who was really a nobody at that time, but he had one splendid gift, and that was oratory. He could mesmerize a crowd and make them believe whatever he wanted them to believe, and they wanted to believe that this man could save them. It started very slowly and very small because a lot of his ideas were completely crackpot. And he was not by no means a Democrat. He didn't believe in the democratic process. He believed that what they needed was to build a huge army of supporters and take over the government. And he sort of began marshaling his forces little by little around himself in order to do that.
One of the most interesting exchanges in the novel comes when Maximilian has met this talented and courageous reporter by the name of Sophie, and they are talking about one of these first rallies at which Adolf Hitler spoke. And Sophie is looking at the drawings that Maximilian has made of this rally, and in particular the way he has depicted Adolf Hitler himself. And at one point in this conversation, Sophie says to Maximilian, "You have to protect yourself. I mean, don't show these drawings to the wrong people." And Maximilian doesn't understand. Protect myself from what? They're just drawings. And she replies, "No, Maximilian, they're not just drawings. They're hand grenades." That's such an interesting notion, that something as seemingly innocent as a drawing could in fact be viewed in such a way. What prompted you to craft this particular conversation and to have Sophie say that?
Well, Maximilian is kind of a naive character, particularly at the beginning. He believes half of the rhetoric he hears, or at least he's willing to overlook it. But she's not. She understands the power of words, and he doesn't, and he doesn't understand the power of his drawings either. So I wanted to talk, at some point, I guess, I wanted to talk about the power of art. Hitler certainly understood the power of art. He started destroying art as soon as he could. And he had a big show of what he called degenerate art, which completely backfired because everybody wanted to see it because it was all of Germany's greatest artists. But he understood the power of images, and certainly Joseph Goebbels, his propaganda minister, understood it. So I thought I wanted a little conversation anyway about that and how powerful his drawings, Maximilian's drawings, but all the other art could be in undoing or trying to undo Hitler and the Nazis.
Mm. At another point later in this conversation between Maximilian and Sophie, she reveals to him, because they've basically just met, that her husband was killed in 1917. And Maximilian says, "I'm sorry, he died for the fatherland."
Yeah.
It was what you said even when you didn't believe it. He died for the fatherland. But she does not believe that. And then she says, "Everybody said he was a hero. The pastor, his family, the officer who came and told me he was dead, they all said he was a hero. But he was not a hero. He was just an ordinary man. He was cannon fodder. He was sent off to die for nothing. Nothing." Maximilian replies, he died for the fatherland. The fatherland is not nothing. And Sophie says, "No, you're right. The fatherland is not nothing. But that war was not for the fatherland. It was for power and influence and greed." To which Maximilian replies, "Don't you want to make Germany great again?" And she says, "It's not what they want to do that's the problem. It's how they want to do it. Germany was great because we have great scientists, great thinkers, great artists. But these guys with their slogans, 'Germany first, make Germany great, the German workers' party,' they want to make it great the way the Huns were great, the way Genghis Khan was great. For them, greatness means vengeance and violence, intimidation and fear." Those are really powerful words. They pack quite a punch.
Yeah, one of the wonderful things about writing novels is you can invent people that are smarter than you are. Sophie is really smart. She's a wonderful character, and she gets her finger right on the pulse of things. I came up with those words, but without her, I couldn't have. I don't know if that makes sense. But without having the character with that intelligence, the words somehow might not have come.
Right. We're speaking with Peter Steiner about his new novel called The Good Cop, set in Munich, Germany, in the early 1920s, that period of tremendous turbulence in the immediate wake of the end of the First World War, when Germany in so many respects was badly crippled. And it is in the midst of that misery that Adolf Hitler rises in prominence. Before we finally get to the character who is, in effect, the good cop, I want to make sure we talk about one of the bad cops, so to speak, in this novel, namely one Hermann Gruber, who actually feels some appreciation for Adolf Hitler, even if not specifically everything that Hitler says. When they first meet after one of these dramatic rallies, you have Hermann thinking to himself, as he said, saying admiring words to Hitler. In fact, Hermann had not paid close attention to Hitler's speech. He had heard that stuff a dozen times. It was being spouted on street corners and in bars all over the city. The betrayal of the fatherland, the dark times they were going through, the return of a mighty Germany. And the Jews, of course, were to blame for everything. It was always the same old political blankety blank to rope in the gullible and the naive. And then Gruber thinks to himself this, but this had been different. The crowd of people were not just persuaded, they were melded into one, lifted up, transported, and ready for action. That seems like a really powerful, potent way to describe what some of these earliest rallies with Adolf Hitler were actually like. Tell us some more about what you understand about what transpired at these rallies and what Hitler was able to accomplish.
Well, I think Gruber says it exactly correctly. Somehow Hitler was able to make people feel like part of something bigger than themselves, to give them a sense of their own power and value that had been missing for them up until that point. It was in his words, of course, but it was also in his oratory, his tone. I mean, a lot of it was nonsense, but it was all sort of uplifting nonsense, sloganeering. And Gruber is interesting because he's maybe a typical German person from that time who was maybe a little cynical about Hitler, but not at all cynical about sort of rising up and improving his own lot and getting ahead. And some of the stuff he says is not so great, but I can make good use of it for my own purposes. And I think that's the same sort of thing that's going on here now a little bit too. People say I don't like the way Trump speaks and behaves, but he's doing good things. But Gruber, he gets in trouble over and over again because, first of all, I don't know if I should even talk about this as maybe giving stuff away, but his wife is Jewish. He never thought of her as a Jew. I mean, she never thought of herself that way. The Jews in Germany were very assimilated. And in order to get ahead, he has to make a choice.
I wonder, as you crafted this novel and as you are describing some of these events, I mean, clearly in the way that you are talking about it, you have brought up the name of our current president more than once and see some intriguing parallels. And certainly in perhaps in matters of policy, but certainly in terms of just sort of the use of a certain kind of maybe kind of theatrical drama and exciting a crowd and that sort of thing. I wonder with what sort of care and caution you are, in a sense, drawing those parallels, because it seems to me that there's probably a temptation to sometimes go too far in the drawing of parallels.
I think that's right. I mean, there are a lot of massive differences between Germany then and America now, and it's easy. I think the Hitler analogy is something that people, I mean, not so many people have been accused of being Hitler, that it's a bit used up. So I'm not saying that Trump is Hitler, but I'm saying that there are certain devices that authoritarians reach for that are always present, you know, when an authoritarian personality comes to power. The denigration of the press, the scapegoating of certain people, and those are real parallels, and they're dangerous, and I think have to be paid attention to.
The good cop, who ultimately becomes the central figure of this novel, is one Willy Geismayr. And he just first of all, in and of himself, is a fascinating character. And of course, you have placed him right in the midst of an incredibly difficult, unpredictable, challenging scenario. First of all, describe to our listeners who Willy Geismeier is, and then, in a sense, almost as important, or maybe even more importantly, where he finds himself at this point in time.
Well, Willy Geismeier, he's a little bit older than Maximilian and Sophie. He was also in the war and was badly injured. He comes from a wealthy family of industrialists and was not, he just was not temperamentally suited to take over the family business. In fact, he aspired to be a Shakespearean scholar and spoke English and went to England and studied at the university there to advance that. But somehow his father? I can't even remember now. Anyway, somehow he found his way into the police department, and he applies all his kind of his British scholarship, his English scholarship to his police work. He has developed this kind of Shakespearean system of police work. And he finds himself, Munich was a Nazi center. It's where Hitler started out, and there just was a huge following almost immediately in Munich. And there was a huge fascist, not Hitlerian, but also fascist movement in outside of. So the police department was riddled with fascists from the beginning. So was the judiciary. Munich was the capital of Bavaria, and Bavaria was a fairly autonomous state. So Willy finds himself pretty isolated in this department because he is not a fascist, and he sees himself as a policeman. He's really rather apolitical. And certain crimes happen that were committed by fascists in the department, and the judges seek to cover them up, and Willy sees it as his job to make sure they don't.
And it's so interesting how certain characters in your novel cannot believe that there can be this kind of corruption. They have been brought up believing that they live in a society founded on law and order, and they are certain that the legal system will be sort of the final line of defense against revolution and chaos. And of course, ultimately, that attitude proves to be tragically naive.
Yes, yeah, it is. I mean, first of all, Germany was in as I said, in turmoil, and the legal system was corrupt, and where it wasn't corrupt, it was weak, and the central government was weak. So whatever if somebody wanted to enforce real justice, it was just that was a pipe dream. The justice that was enforced was the justice that came from the street, essentially.
As you crafted your novel, and in particular as you grappled with this whole notion of what it means to be a good cop and what it means to be a bad cop, what did you think about in terms of kind of wrestling with the true meaning of those words? Because I think those are labels that we sometimes kind of toss around actually rather carelessly without really stopping to think about the essential difference between the two.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In fact, I was not, when I was thinking about the good cop, I was not thinking about a cop at all. I was thinking about the ordinary citizen, myself. And what would I do in a circumstance like Willy's, where not necessarily my job to enforce the law, but it is my job to uphold the law. And if I see the law being broken, how much courage would I have in the face of some of the odds that the German citizens were facing? You know, if you're walking down the street and you see somebody, let's put it in the United States right now to make it more tangible, see somebody abusing a Muslim, what would you do? What would I do? Would I sort of hustle by and try to avert my eyes, or would I intervene even if this person who was abusing that person was bigger than me or stronger than me or younger than me? Those are the kind of questions that have always interested me in my other books as well, in different ways. What is courage? I guess that's what it all comes down to. What is courage?
One very intriguing choice that you make is when you give us the backstory of one of the darkest figures in the novel, someone by the name of Konrad Milch. And he is not actually in the novel all that long, and yet he is a really important figure. And, you know, he would be, to put it bluntly, one of the bad guys, one of the worst of the bad guys. But the way we initially meet him is we get at least an idea of why he is the way he is, or why he is who he is. Just tell our listeners a little bit about this character and why it apparently was very important to you to share his story this way, not just as a present-day villain, but some of the backstory that led him there.
Yeah. Well, I'll answer the second part of that first. I'm interested in real people in my novels. I don't want the characters who are entirely evil or entirely virtuous. I want everybody to be as rounded a real person as I can possibly make them. And as you say, Milch is responsible for some terrible deeds, but he has a tortured childhood. He has a father who is physically abusive and neglectful, and a mother who is incapable of offering him any love at all. And he has his only savior is an older sister who takes care of him as best she can. And the most redeeming quality I could think to give him was that he loves to sing. You can probably relate to that. You're a musician.
I am.
And he just adores singing. And I think the thing that attracts him more than anything, well, the violence attracts him to the Nazis, but the marching and singing is what he really loves. And I somehow felt like that's a bit of redemption in some way.
Right. I guess that's one of the things that I so appreciated, is that we get a sense of the human being behind what might otherwise just be kind of the villainous exterior, and while it does not excuse any of the things that he does and says and believes, it helps us understand why he is who he is at this point in his life.
Yeah. We like to believe, I think, that there are monsters in the world, that evil comes from monsters, that Adolf Hitler was a monster. He did monstrous things, but he was a human being. And obviously not trying to excuse anything, but he was one of us. And I think that's important that we don't ever forget that. I mean, we all have tremendous good in us, and we all have, I suspect, tremendous evil if we choose to find it.
Was it at all worrisome to you to write a novel set where it was and tackling some of the issues that it does, both for the sense of drawing some parallels, whether purposefully or inadvertently, to the present day, but also the fact that that a lot has been written about this period? Was it intimidating to you to be tackling this particular kind of story, or did you just feel drawn to it irresistibly?
It was not intimidating to me, and probably because I'm a fool about such things. I kind of rush in. It was tremendously attractive and interesting to me because of my own life history, and because of what's going on now in the world, not just here but elsewhere. And I guess if I were a young writer starting out trying to have a career as a writer, I might have stayed away from it. But no, it didn't intimidate me. And as for so much having been written about it, that's kind of a liberation rather than a problem. I don't know a fraction of what has been done about this period. I haven't read everything. I haven't even read most of it, and there's no way that I possibly could. But I guess, and writing a work of fiction gives me some license too. I felt free to make up things I didn't really know.
Well, the book is riveting in so many respects, and thought-provoking in the richest sense of the word. The novel, again, is titled The Good Cop, published by Severn House, and its author, Peter Steiner. Peter Steiner, I so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about your excellent novel. Thank you so much for making time for The Morning Show and your busy schedule, and best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. It was a lovely interview. Thanks very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be speaking with Jim Schatzman and Racine D.A. Patricia Hansen about this week's upcoming Employer Reentry Expo. This is an event which is designed to help employers ultimately reconnect with a portion of the labor market that they've maybe not tapped into before, people who have been recently incarcerated. And we'll also explore the importance of helping the recently incarcerated to re-enter the labor force and become meaningful parts of society. On Wednesday, young tenor Nick Huff, a recent graduate of Carthage College who has done all kinds of exciting things over the last couple of years, including singing in a couple of different world premieres. And Nick is back in these parts and singing a recital Friday night at the Kenosha Creative Space in downtown Kenosha. Also, Tommy Novak from Carthage College, who is on the staff there, talks about an interesting event coming up there this weekend in which some alums who were part of a production back in 2010 are reconnecting and presenting a stage reading of that play, I believe called Room Service. Such an interesting project, and we'll be hearing about that. On Thursday, Lisa Kornetsky is here to talk about the production which she has just guest directed at the Racine Theater Guild of Neil Simon's wonderful play Lost in Yonkers, which opened this past Friday and is running for the next two weekends. And on Friday, Robert Haggerty Jr. talks about the work that he is doing. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a
Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD.